We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. Theodore Geisel, probably better known by his pen name, Dr. Seuss, is one of our best-known and most-loved children's writers. Early in his career, though, he struggled. He went through a number of rejections, by his count, 27 or 28, before a college friend would publish his very first book. He only wrote Green Eggs and Ham to settle a bet that he couldn't write a children's book in under 50 words. But certainly he managed to overcome those early difficulties and become a very, very important writer, both important writer and important artist. In this hour, Focus, we'll try to explore something of the life of Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, as we talk with Donald Pease, who is a professor of English at Ted Geisel's alma mater, Dartmouth. Our guest is interested in modern American literature and is, in fact, an authority, one of the leading authorities on the work of Theodore Geisel, as well as being an authority on 19th and 20th century literature. He's professor of English, comparative literature, African-American literature at Dartmouth. He is also the Ted and Helen Geisel Chair in the Humanities there, and is author of a book about Ted Geisel that is entitled Theodore Seuss Geisel. It's part of the Lives and Legends series put out by the Oxford University Press, and was, I'm sure, something of a challenge because they said it could only be 150 pages long.
Yes.
So it is a brief book, and it was supposed to be something that would be accessible to readers of a very wide
age range.
And so we appreciate his being here, and we are here now back live as usual, and if people want to call in, ask questions, make comments, they certainly may. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, again, thanks very much for being here.
It's a delight to be here. Thanks for inviting me, David.
I'm sure that we are used to thinking about writers, novelists particularly, using their lives as the source of the writing, sometimes mistakenly. I'm sure that novelists have to contend all the time with people assuming that somehow their writing is about them. But you can't divorce the person's work from their life. And I think what you do with this book that's really interesting is talk about his life and talk about the experiences that he had and how all of that one way or another ends up being reflected in the work. And, you know, maybe we don't quite think about it as much with a writer that writes primarily for a young audience as we do for one who writes for adults.
It's true. Ted Geisel transformed some of his early childhood experience into the basis for his first successful children's book, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, which is, in fact, the result of his, as a little boy, having been subjected on Mulberry Street to some word wounds. He was the child of German immigrants, the scion of a very prosperous brewery, Kambach and Geisel in Springfield. Classmates used to say it was the Comeback and Guzzle Brewery. But when World War I was approaching, a lot of the attitude, the favorable attitude towards the German immigrant community underwent a sea change. Mm-hmm. And when he'd go back and forth from school, kids would throw brickbats at him and say, let's kill the Kaiser's kid. Let's get the drunken Hun. When he was coming back from Germany with his wife, Helen, he experienced at sea a trauma. There was a terrible storm that put him back in touch with the trauma getting home from school on Mulberry Street. And that drew him into a story about a little boy who needed to get home with a story that would somehow enable him to feel at home on Mulberry Street. He was working through all of those childhood difficulties, those word wounds, by creating word magic for a little boy that turned wounds into what could be called word blessings. Yeah. That for him was the vocation of a children's writer.
And this was quite a bit later. This was after he had already been through high school. He'd been to Dartmouth. He'd been to Oxford. He had been in Europe, and this was on his return, having met the woman that would become his wife. And at that point, he had gone to Oxford, where he wasn't particularly well received because he was an American. He thought that the dons there were tedious in the extreme. And the story is, I guess he was sitting there in some lecture and he was doodling. And the woman that would become his wife saw the drawings and she said to him something like, you don't want to be an English professor, Ted. You want to be an artist. And the fact that she said that perhaps gave him permission to then embark on that path, which is what he maybe in his heart of hearts, what he really wanted.
He was fabulously successful on Madison Avenue as an artist tycoon. He created a punchline, Quick Henry the Flit, that had become part of Broadway lyrics. It was the signature close for the Fred Allen Show. Jack Benny used the line. He could have made a fortune if he'd remained within that particular rubric. But when he was at Oxford and Helen saw him drawing a flying cow, and he had told her initially he wanted to be an English professor, she tapped him on the shoulder and said, "What you really want to do is make your life part of the creation of figures only you can add to the world." Initially, he did that with ads. Mm-hmm. But then he felt, when he was coming back from Germany and felt the child in him in need of something that would sustain him, he was called into writing a children's book that brought him in touch with the figure who stood behind Helen, who was his mother, Nettie, who used to sing him children's rhymes when he was a little boy and trying to traverse the territory between waking state and dream state, and found in her rhymes, but also in the doodles he'd put on the bedroom wall, a way to get to sleep without being somehow taken over by fear or nightmare.
It's really interesting that here in his childhood, there was this dislocation that comes with, first of all, he was part of this family that initially was considered, well, one of the pillars of the community. Then he and his family, like a lot of other German Americans around the time of World War II, experienced a lot of harassment. For him, writing, drawing seemed to be a kind of escape. And I think here, too, what's really important, and you just touched on, is that maybe in his lifetime there were two women who were very, very important sources of affirmation for him. One, this woman who was his wife, but the other certainly would be his mother from the very beginning.
Yes. And then the woman who appeared in his life after Helen died tragically of a reaction to Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a debilitating disease. Mm-hmm. What's not known about Ted Geisel, or not sufficiently known, is that he had as many hats as Benjamin Cubb, that he could have been a successful advertising man. When World War II was approaching, he gave up all of that security in order to write political satire against Hitler's Germany and in order thereby to work through all the pent-up rage that he felt against an authoritarian Germany that had made German immigrants to the United States feel as if they had no place. He became so successful at creating political satire that FDR invoked his satire as one of the strongest dimensions of the war effort. And during World War II, he signed on at the age of 41 to work with Frank Capra. Imagine Frank Capra and Dr. Seuss working together to produce war propaganda. They created Know Your Enemy Germany, Know Your Enemy Japan, and the famous comic series Private Snafu, Situation Normal, all fouled up in order to give joy to the troops. It wasn't until after World War II when Geisel suddenly felt, God, I've become like those boys who threw brickbats at me. I'm using my art to create hostility and aggression, to create satire. He said, I want to, after the war, create books that'll get the war mentality out of children. I want to address the baby boom generation and try to solicit from them not aggressive humor, but the unconditional laughter that children know and adults forgot, where you laugh for the sheer fun of what is the source of your laughter. Mm-hmm.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Donald Pease. He's a professor of English at Dartmouth. He is the Ted and Helen Geisel Chair in the Humanities. He is an authority on the work of Ted Geisel, better known, no doubt, by his pen name, Dr. Seuss. He is the author of the book Theodore Seuss Geisel. It's part of the Lives and Legacies series of the Oxford University Press, out certainly in the bookstore if you'd like to find it. Came out last year, 2010?
October, yes. It came out at the beginning of 2010.
And he's here visiting the campus. We're pleased that he could be spending some time with us in the studio. Questions, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. It's also worth talking about what he did for children's literature that was really revolutionary. And I think he was challenged in a way, or perhaps challenged himself, to produce something that children would want to read, and that also would accomplish the task of getting children to understand that there was this relationship between those marks on the page and real stuff in the world, and that his books like Cat in the Hat really accomplished both those things. And I don't know if we, you know, when you read them, you love the text, that's fun. You can easily remember them. The drawings are great. But the technical achievement there, I think, is something that you don't really understand unless you really pay attention to it.
Yes, he was given an awesome challenge prior to writing Cat in the Hat. John Hersey had written a very famous article in The New Yorker about the problem with Johnny learning how to read. It was a time in which the United States was fearful of falling behind the Soviet Union in the capacity to produce a literate, technologically savvy culture that could compete with our rival throughout the Cold War. And there were, in that essay, John Hersey said, why can't a children's book genius of the standing of Dr. Seuss write a children's book that'll make children want to learn how to read? Now, when he was given this challenge, Dr. Seuss had to imagine a character who would enable children, upon seeing that character, to want to learn how to link letters on the page with the images that were the reference for those letters, to marry words and images. And so he had as his intention the need to create the reading process personified. The Cat in the Hat is the means whereby images get linked to words that inhabits the children as they encounter the cat, so that they want, as the book is being read to them, to do what Sally, and let's call him Johnny, do within the story. That is produced through their relationship with this wild, imaginative, enjoyable energy called the cat. Mm-hmm. Link the things the cat picks up with the precarious status of those things that he juggles on the page, so that in the process of reading, they can engage those things on the page with the words through which those things not only become audible, but in a sense, imaginable. They can, as they read and have the book read to them, and enter into the process, the miracle when that happens whenever suddenly the process of seeing printed image on a page gets linked to the printed letters on the page in a way that lets you feel as if you're reading by yourself. Mm-hmm. That book became the basis for a whole series of books called Beginner's Books that became the pedagogical supplement for teachers of reading across the country.
Mm-hmm. Something else that it's interesting, that book is interesting for its structure in the sense of the arc of the story, where you go from the beginning where the children are there and things are just sort of boring and normal and it's an average day. And then we have the introduction of this anarchic character who comes and turns everything upside down. And then, but then at the end, things get restored again back to normal. And this idea of a story arc is something that he was very interested in. And I think he did that over and over again.
Yes. Dr. Seuss was careful to make certain that this interruption in the everyday reality of these children, it's a boring winter day. They can't go outside and play. And suddenly they hear this bump that is the interruption of the relationship between time and space that constitutes the reality. And the story can be construed as the children's production of a whole set of imaginative possibilities that could have caused this bump. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could have been a domestic cat knocking over a goldfish bowl. But when that everyday answer to the cause of the bump is replaced by this figure who appears as if he's come out of their cartoon world, a child's cartoon world, entered their everyday reality and enabled them thereby to enter into a world of, call it, foundational fantasy that isn't a frightening for them but is enabling for them, until at the very end of that they can say to the cat, pick up your things and get out. You've made a mess of the house, and we're going to recover our reality before Mother returns. Dr. Seuss was careful to make certain that the cat, instead of being a source of fear for the children, remained a source of play by turning his presence in the house into the occasion for the children's taking imaginative possession of the domain of the cat, which is really the domain of reading as such.
And it also, I think, shows you that it illustrates this theme that he also wrote again and again about. He seemed very much concerned about empowerment of small, marginalized, otherwise not powerful individuals, in some cases children, but not always children. I mean, they might be something, might be a real big kind of a creature, but yet someone who was sort of shoved aside, who continued to get this message, well, you're not important. And he seemed very, very concerned with speaking to how, you know, that part in everyone that feels that at some time.
No, that's a great insight. The other event in his childhood was for him the source of his need to create children's books in which kids who were bullied or anyone who was bullied was brought back into center stage, a place when he was 14 years old, after his grandfather, to prove the family's patriotism, had made certain that his grandson, Ted, had sold more Liberty Bonds than any other boy in Springfield, Massachusetts. The news of this success brought perhaps the most notorious political figure of the day, another Theodore Roosevelt, to Springfield Auditorium, Municipal Auditorium, to award all the little boys who'd sold Liberty Bonds, blue medals. And there were 10 little boys on the stage. Roosevelt went to each little boy, delivered an honorific, and then planted the blue ribbon on the chest of each boy until he came to 14-year-old Ted Geisel, and he'd run out of blue ribbons. And then Theodore Roosevelt pulled himself up into his full stentorian posture and bellowed down at Ted Geisel, "What are you doing here, little boy? And who are you?" Geisel, years later, said Empty Pants was born at that stage. And I began to feel the creation of all the Whos in Whoville. Who are you, little boy? The need to take a person who's been utterly humiliated, who feels as if there's no place in the world, and to give that person all of the sustenance, all of the uplift that a Dr. Seuss story and a Dr. Seuss caricature can facilitate was also the deep source of his vocation as a writer.
Yeah. What an amazing moment that it must have been. Poor Ted, he was there lined up to get his medal, and then it just happened to run out, and somehow Roosevelt was looking at it like, well, obviously I don't have any more medals, so you can't be in line for a medal and to be singled out. And I guess poor Ted, they just yanked him off the stage.
They pulled him off the stage. This happened in front of 10,000 citizens in Springfield. The Geisel family had gone to the event to be reaffirmed as citizens and patriots. And it was after that moment that Ted Geisel developed the art of satire, which is targeted aggression, where the aggression that had been directed against him as a little boy, he then turned into the art of control. You can call satire the capacity to take the aggression that would otherwise be directed at you and redirect it and transform it into a source of laughter that you control, rather than yourself becoming the object or target of the aggression. And throughout his years in high school and throughout his years at Dartmouth, he developed the sophisticated arts of caricature, satire, invective that saw him through the first two of his careers, first as a Madison Avenue artist tycoon, where that gift became a means of selling flit, an insecticide, and then as the primary political cartoonist for PM magazine that worked to get the United States into the war against Hitler. It isn't until after the war that he sees children's books as a way of creating a satire on the need to satirize. All of his children's books can be described as efforts to take figures who would otherwise be in a completely antagonistic relationship to one another, the Sneetches, for example, or Yertle the Turtle in relation to all the turtles under Yertle, and create a means whereby the deep bond that is otherwise hidden beneath that antagonism can suddenly shine through, no matter whether you're a Sneetch with star or a Sneetch without a star. He wants to, in his children's book, create a means whereby children can enjoy a life without the need to produce an enemy.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Donald Pease. He's professor of English, comparative literature, and African-American literature at Dartmouth College, where he's also Ted and Helen Geisel Chair in the Humanities. He is, among other things, authority on the work of Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss. He's also an authority on 19th and 20th century American literature. And he is the author of the book, Theodore Seuss Geisel. It's a brief biography and also an inquiry into the sources of Ted Geisel's art. And it is published by the Oxford University Press, part of their Lives and Legacies series. And questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We talked a little bit about some of the difficulties that he experienced as a German-American around World War One. The family made their money early on in brewing. They had a brewery, but that was destroyed by Prohibition.
Volstead Act.
So he really had a lot of early dislocation, but it sounds as if he really found an important home for himself at Dartmouth. This was a place where he was well-liked, and it sounded like he had a great time there.
Yes. When he came to Dartmouth, he had lost both the family livelihood in the brewery. He'd also lost the extended German-American community. His sense of belonging had been, to use your word, utterly dislocated. So he came to Dartmouth looking for an alternative family. Dartmouth was for him what Freud would call a family romance space, where you get the family you want. And he created for himself at Dartmouth a position, a role, as the chief writer for the Jack-O-Lantern Humor magazine that established for him a position of prominence, of even preeminence on the stage. This was a time in which that humor magazine would sell on the street corners of Boston and New York and Chicago as a humor magazine that would today be competitive with the New Yorker and in its capacity to solicit an audience. Mm-hmm. And Geisel felt from the moment he established his relationship with fellow writers on that humor magazine, as if he had found the identity and the family he needed to enable him to feel secure and as if he belonged. But then in his senior year, an event happened that brought back, even recapitulated, all of the sources of his childhood trauma. He organized a party in late April after he'd been elected the editor-in-chief of Jacko, the identity that he wanted throughout his 4 years. And he'd received permission from the then president of Dartmouth to get gin from a bootlegger up the river in White River, who Ernest Martin Hopkins said was producing non-poisonous bootleg gin.
This was the college-sanctioned
bootleg. It was college-authorized. So he had the party, and this was a time in April, as you might imagine, in which the plumbing was still somewhat challenged because of the weather conditions. And so late into the evening, a couple of the boys went onto the roof and performed a bodily function, sometimes mistaken for my last name. And as a consequence of that, the sheriff of Hanover called the dean of Dartmouth and said, these boys have violated not only the law of prohibition, but they've done so on the holiest day of the Christian calendar. It was Holy Saturday. And that dean, his name was Craven Laycock, told Ted Geisel that he could not have his name on the jack-o'-lantern and could never again until his graduation publish anything in the magazine. He was devastated. He wrote in his diary that he felt as if the rock had been rolled up against the tomb. And it wasn't until 3 days later that he recovered sufficiently to decide to begin to send cartoons and caricatures to the Jacko under a series of pseudonyms. He first took the name of the warden of Sing Sing Prison, Matt Osborne, then Louis Pasteur, then Francis Gabriel Rossetti. And finally, on April 21st, he drew an image of a goat with its front hooves on a lower mountain peak, its back hooves on a higher with drooping udders, and under it the caption, and goat's milk, the price of goat's milk's gone up this year, signed S-E-U-S-S, Seuss. What he'd done to get by the dean's justice was take his mother Nettie's maiden name, Henrietta Seuss, and use it to get by the dean's censor. Now, just think about this. This was the dean's having said, you cannot any longer publish in the Jacko, was for him a repetition of what Roosevelt had said. Who are you, little boy? It recalled him to his experience of being hit by brickbats. Let's kill the Kaiser's kid. So that his going to the secret name, Seuss, his mother's maiden name, was touching base with the resource figure whose children's rhymes had enabled him to traverse a comparably insuperable passage from daytime fear to nighttime dream-filled sleep, so that when he gave himself that name and thereby enabled himself to get by this terrible impasse, he was also touching quite literally what could be called the mother lode in his creative imagination, the implications of which he wouldn't become fully aware until he decided to become a children's book writer after World War II, after he'd passed through experiential loss and decided to turn it into imaginative comic gain for children, that not only the child for whom he was writing, but the child in himself, who was the permanent ally and permanent resource for all of his children's books.
So where does the doctor come in here?
He initially called himself Dr. Seuss in cartoons that he did for Judge magazine when he began writing after leaving Oxford. And he said he called himself Doctor because it gave him the honorific he would have had he become an English professor, a Ph.D. When Dartmouth gave him his first of 8 honorary degrees in 1955, he says, well, I guess I'm now Dr. Seuss. The doctor was, for him, deeply linked to the capacity of the Seuss figure to heal, to do something to restore wholeness to a shattered sense of self.
His we talked about what an important figure his mom was for him in terms of being someone who affirmed him and believed in him and the fact that he was and would indeed become somebody important, to the point when he had drawn on the walls of his room when he was a kid and Dad wanted to wash it off. Mom said, no, leave that there.
Yes. And when his mom said, no, leave that there, you can also see that as a prefiguration of the dean saying, no, you cannot put any more images on the jack-o'-lantern, the latter-day equivalent of his bedroom walls. When his mother said, no, those bedroom walls will one day become valuable, she was right. When he revisited Springfield back in 1986 and he was subject to universal acclaim, children would hold placards 50 years after the publication of And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street saying, and to think that I saw him on Mulberry Street. And he returned to 74 Fairfield Street, where he'd grown up, and told the little boy who was then living in his bedroom that underneath the wallpaper he would find on the plasterboard images that Dr. Seuss had imprinted there in order to oversee the border between waking and sleeping. All of his images, by the way, were linked to, you know, his early images were modeled after a stuffed dog who stayed with him. His mother gave it to him when he was 4 years old. The dog was called Theophrastus. He took that dog with him to Dartmouth. He would always keep it as close to his writing pad as possible. And Carla Kuskin, the poet, when she saw the dog and then saw his writing, said, all of your images look like the Mona Lisa after her first martini. And when you see Theophrastus' face, you'll see Mona Lisa after the first martini. That dog was also, as a transitional object, his permanent linkage with Nettie. Mm.
She didn't really get to see him be the success that he was. His dad did. Did he come around to the idea that his son was Dr. Seuss?
He did. It took Ted a long time to work through his dad's initial feeling of having been himself rejected by the... He was in line to become the president and general manager of the most successful brewery in the Northeast, the Kalmbach and Geisel. When Prohibition hit, he was devastated. Ted wrote that he went into his bedroom and for 6 years he heard him say, damn those SOBs, over and over and over again. And so the Springfield cycle, a series of books that begins with And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, that includes If I Ran the Zoo, If I Ran the Circus, those books are all about bringing his dad into Dr. Seuss's, Ted Geisel's fantasy world, so that finally in If I Ran the Circus, when he imagines through the character of Mr. Snelock, a figure who is modeled after his dad, he's able to write as the dedication to that last of the books about Springfield. This is for Big Ted of Springfield, the finest man I know. That book was the book that produced the reconciliation between Ted and T.R. That otherwise was missing. It was T.R. who told the dean, I affirm you're breaking the tie between Ted and the jack-o'-lantern. That break with his dad is also what caused him to produce an even deeper attachment to Soyce, Henrietta, until the writing of the whole series of books, Mulberry Street, McGilligot's Pool, If I Ran the Zoo, If I Ran the Circus, finally came full cycle and enabled the boy who was setting out for Mulberry Street to include his father in the sights and fantasies that he enjoyed along the way.
Yeah, you people remember earlier, in a little earlier, you talked about the famous or infamous party and how that had got him in trouble, and the dean, this much feared dean, talked to Ted's dad, and they wanted to make sure that the punishment was something that he would really feel. And apparently, the dean said to Ted's dad, "What's the worst thing that we could do to Ted?" And Ted's dad said, "You take away from him his participation in the Jack-o'-lantern, the Dartmouth Literary Magazine. That was the worst thing that you could do." So his dad, in fact, conspired in this punishment. It seemed that his dad, and maybe also his grandfather, how the family was seen, the family reputation, was extremely important to them. And anything that would tarnish the family name was what you do anything to avoid that.
Yeah. And that's also why you see in Dr. Seuss the need to create a parental voice that will say to children what Ted's dad had not said to Ted when he was a little boy. If you think about the voice, the intergenerational voice that's produced in his valediction story, the story he writes knowing that he's going to die, oh, the places you'll go. You hear in that voice, listen, kid, you'll move mountains. The resonant flow of an adult who feels the need to produce, as if it's the only legacy he can pass on, a voice that will be so supportive and so uplifting and so affirming of a child's capacity to move through the world, that voice, which is the transformation of his dad's voice, becomes also the permanent doctor in Dr. Seuss.
And again, you know, we talked about how important his mom and his wife were. But it seems that he ultimately, that voice, and maybe, I don't know if it was what he was looking for was that voice to come from his father or from somebody at that, a kind of paternal authority figure. He ended up providing that voice for himself. He created a character that was an extension of himself to be that voice, to say those things to everybody who would encounter the work, but also to himself.
Yes. I think that's a great insight, David. And when you think about that insight in relation to the story Horton Hears a Who, it's about a creature who knows that there is a cry of help, a cry for help coming from an alternative world that the elephant feels utterly responsible for both securing and sustaining. It's when Horton gets the rest of the jungle not only to acknowledge that such a voice could exist, but to hear it into existence. That's not just the voice of Dr. Seuss. It's the voice of the child in Whoville, the voice of the little boy who feels most marginal in all of Whoville, suddenly having his yop added to all of the voices, so that the child's need to be heard is what is somehow not only healing the child and healing Whoville, but also all of the jungle community that's organized around not acknowledging the possibility of ever hearing that cry for help. Dr. Seuss writes Horton Hears a Who after World War II in order to link himself with the person he was before he gave up writing children's books to enter into PM. The first children's book he wrote about Horton was Horton Hatches the Egg, and he wrote that as he was deciding to give up both his advertising career and children's books and enter into the world of political propaganda with PM. Mm-hmm. He needed to return to Horton in order literally to hear what, in the logic of the observation you made, was literally his vocation. He was heard back into the writer of children's books by writing Horton Hears a Who. When he wrote that book, he after World War II, had lots of offers. Jack Warner offered him a screenplay writing position. He wanted him to write the script for Rebel Without a Cause. He told him that after he'd received Oscar for Know Your Enemy Germany and Know Your Enemy Japan, that he would have a permanent post in Hollywood. But when Dr. Seuss came back from the war, he began to feel this deep, deep need to write works that would enable him both to get over his own wartime experience and in order to bring a generation of children into existence that wouldn't need to sustain that mentality. So he asked his then editor, if he could live on children's books, if he could make $5,000 a year. That's all he wanted. This is a man who made the equivalent of $1 million a year writing ads after graduating from Dartmouth. And she said, yeah, sure, you could do it. It wasn't until he wrote Cat on the Hat that Dr. Seuss began to make more than $5,000 a year. Cat in the Hat became a Word of Playground bestseller. It was the children who began to demand that their parents purchase that book itself. 12,000 books a month after its initial appearance until it sold $2 million copies in its first 3 years. That caused a retroactive effect so that children's books that had been written prior to Cat, for example, Horton Hears a Who had sold 5,000 copies, and then it diminished to about 150 copies. But after the publication of Cat in 57, in 58, it went up to 75,000, then up to 200,000 copies. Comparable shifts in scale happened for all of his children's books until Dr. Seuss became the most successful children's book writer of all time.
Our guest, let me just very quickly, for anybody who has maybe join us in the last 10 minutes or so, I would like to introduce the guest, Don Pease. He's professor of English at Dartmouth. He's the Ted and Helen Geisel Chair in the Humanities there. He's an authority on the work of Theodore Geisel, also known as Dr. Seuss, author of the book Theodore Seuss Geisel. It's published by Oxford University Press. It's part of their Lives and Legacies series, and he's here visiting the campus and was good enough to come and spend some time with us. We do have time for questions. Someone wants to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that he had a number of different careers and could have stayed in advertising and made a lot of money. He could have been in Hollywood and made a lot of money, and he decided to become the children's writer. He did make a movie, and it was not a big success. It's a strange but very interesting little movie. I've actually seen The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, and you can see in the arc of that story and some of the things in that story, they're the same themes that you see in his writing. And it's a very interesting and odd little movie, which also makes me think, would not have been, if he could have exercised the kind of technology that we have now, particularly to do animated films, what he possibly could have produced. It's kind of staggering to think about that.
Well, I think that this technology would have enabled his skills to transect a whole set of alternative worlds and possibilities. But that movie because it was the only full-scale disaster in Ted Geisel's otherwise utterly successful, unimaginably successful career in Hollywood. That movie, its failure, became the basis for his deciding to break ties with Hollywood altogether. Mm. Because he said, when I make movies, I have to do it by committee. I have to do it with a group of, and it impedes my control over my vision, and it also makes it impossible for me to make final approval on the cuts. He said it was a debaculous. He makes up the word. It was a debaculous failure. And I'll say nothing until all of the persons involved for its failure are dead, including myself.
Well, I think that he's selling the movie a little short, but it's as I say, a couple of years ago, I just happened to catch it sort of by accident. They were showing it on AMC one evening, and I thought, well, that's really interesting. And I sat down and watched it, and
it is interesting.
It is. There are a lot of interesting things about it. It has a sort of a surreal
totally
quality
surreal.
To
Hans
it.
Hans Conried and Tommy Redding of Lassie fame starring in it. And it does have all of the Seussian themes about a little boy or a series of them getting pushed around by horrifying authoritarian figures, the infamous Dr. T. But it's also uneven, and yeah. It doesn't quite hold together. The surreal could be used as a justification for some of the associative and disjoint cuts. But dislocation is not a principle of art, and that film is deeply dislocated.
Yeah. Right. Well, we have a caller here. We'll get in the time that remains. Someone who is in Mattoon, so we'll get right to them on our line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Enjoying the conversation. Let me compliment your guests. I had no background at all on Dr. Seuss, the history of where he came from, so I was terribly fascinated. I have to tell you, I'm in my 50s and my wife's in her 40s, and the Christmas show at Dr. Seuss, we never miss it. And we bring our kids in to watch it, and it just kind of transcends the generations. So, but I actually had a couple of questions for your guest, I guess maybe to wax philosophical if he'd like to, wondering what he would think of what Hollywood's done with Jim Carrey and Cat on the Hat, and maybe what Dr. Seuss would make out of that. And then given the technology of the media, wondering if your guest could comment on it would be possible to have another future Dr. Seuss come out of where he came out of. And then finally, going back to Christmas time, wondering if there was any comparison to Charles Schulz and Peanuts, if those people had any sort of connection together, anything that your guests would like to comment on, any or all of that. Okay. I'll hang up.
And I have to warn you that we have about two, I can give you about 2 minutes. I know that.
Yeah, all of those questions are good questions. Charles Schulz was also brought up in a German-American community and experienced comparable dissociations, and he created the Peanuts world and the Linus blanket out of a sense of the need to come back from World War II in ways that have profound resonances with Ted Geisel's comparable needs. I think that the choice of Jim Carrey as Cat and all of the variations produced on the doc have to do with Hollywood's great sense that the cat is really an id personified. And if there is any actor who can get as close to the kind of zany, over-the-top behavior of the figure Dr. Seuss created in order to entice children to want to become involved in the reading process, it's Jim Carrey. I think that that's a wonderful choice of figures to play Dr. Seuss. Finally, I think that this new world of technological invention that the internet and all of the innovative possibilities of the new technology facilitates will solicit future Dr. Seusses who enable us to have, as if it is an unforetold gift, figures like the Grinch who can make seasons that otherwise feel somehow banal become occasions for letting the heart grow three times as large.
Well, at that gives us a good place to stop, and we will have to because we're here at the end of the time. I want to mention again, if you'd like to read about the work of Dr. Seuss, about Theodore Seuss Geisel, and about his life and how his life experiences ended up being channeled into his art and how he became the person that we know as Dr. Seuss, you might look at the book that I've mentioned now a couple of times, Theodore Seuss Geisel, by our guest Don Pease. It's part of the Lives and Legacies series of the Oxford University Press, so you can seek the book out in the bookstore. Our guest Don Pease is professor of English, comparative literature, African-American literature at Dartmouth, where Ted Geisel went to school. He is the Ted and Helen Geisel Chair in the Humanities and was here visiting the campus and was good enough to spend some time with us. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for this wonderful interview.